today. A wind chill advisory in effect until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning. Sunny, windy, and continued very cold today. We'll see wind chills down to 20 below zero. Overnight, continued windy and bitterly cold. Tonight's low 8 below. Wind chills down to 27 below. Here's how the weekend shakes out. Saturday, sunny, continued very cold. A high of 12 above, but wind chills down to 28 below. That's for Saturday. Sunday, we finally break out of the deep freeze. Sunday, cloudy and a 20% chance of snow with a high of 26. As a matter of fact, that sets the stage for a relatively mild week. Monday through Thursday at this point, cloudy, temperatures in the 20s. All 4 days. Right now, sun is shining, the sky is blue, wind is from the west at 13 miles per hour, 3 degrees above zero in Racine, 2 above in Kenosha, 0 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, wind chill 15 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News time is 8:11. The morning show up next. Support for WGTD's morning show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities online at carthage.edu.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTDHD. I'm Gregory Berg. On today's program, you're going to be hearing one of my most memorable interviews from 2014, when I had the opportunity to speak with writer Gail Sheehy, responsible for 17 different books, a number of them huge bestsellers, including the book Passages, which was named by the Library of Congress as one of the 10 most influential books in American history. Gail Sheehy wrote with distinguished success for many years for Vanity Fair magazine and for a number of other publications as well. A memoir she has just written chronicles her early life and her rise to prominence during the 1960s and 70s. Her book is called Daring, My Passages, a Memoir, published by William Morrow and Company.
My career as a writer challenged me to dare. I had to pull on hooker boots and top pants and walk the streets with streetwalkers to expose a violent period of prostitution in New York, and that made a very successful series, magazine series. I was brash enough to follow Hillary Clinton into the ladies' room when we were both speaking at a conference, and she let her hair down. It was 1995, and she was being blamed for the Democrats' disastrous defeat in the midterm election. And she just threw up her hands and said, "I don't know what to do anymore. Nothing I do seems to work." And we had a long talk about the white male backlash against her as first lady. And finally she laid out a strategy and said, "You know, it's not me they're afraid of. It's the changes I represent." And this was how she was going to counteract that. So that launched 10 years of writing for Vanity Fair about Bill and Hillary Clinton, and ultimately writing a biography of her called Hillary's Choice. So excavating all of this and my feelings about my the shortchanging for my daughter of having a mother present much of the time, although I had a wonderful housekeeper who came and lived with us and was with me for 33 years. So I had, she had a second mom. And then when Clay and I lived together and later married, he was a wonder, Clay Felker, the founder of New York Magazine and the mentor who shaped my early career. And he adored Maura, and she was fascinated by him, so she did have a wonderful stepfather. But these were painful excavations. Mm. Should I have done this? Should I have spent more time there? Should I have, you know, denied taking this assignment? But then put yourself in my shoes. I'm, 28 years old? Oh, no, it's 1968. Clay Felker has just launched New York Magazine as an independent publication. He comes barging into my apartment after the launch party. Where were you? Why weren't you at the launch party? I couldn't go. I didn't have a babysitter. I don't have a gown. He said, what do you know about politics? I said, well, I mean, my mother's a natural-born Irish rebel. My father's a country club Republican. So what I know about politics, it's about arguing at the dinner table. And he said, then you'll understand Bobby. I said, Bobby who? He said, Bobby Kennedy. I want you to go out and follow his campaign in California. I said, I've never written a political story. He said, now's the time to start. You have to leave in 2 days. So I ummed and ahed and butt and like have to get a babysitter and so on. He said, Gail, look, the way to make your name as a journalist is not to write a lot of little stories. No matter how interesting they are, it's not going to start a new conversation. What you have to do is tackle a big story, something everybody's talking about, but they don't know the why. So I took that dare, and I had one of the last interviews with Bobby Kennedy before he was assassinated.
So your story is so much about doors opening to you, and in so many cases, unexpectedly. And the question then of whether or not you dare step through that door or hang back for whatever reason. And, of course, that ends up shaping what's really an amazing series of passages for you through this long, fascinating career.
Well, it's true. And, you know, the title might sound like, oh, wow, she thinks she's fearless. That's totally the opposite. I'm a normally fearful person. I've even had a couple of panic attacks. What I've had to learn, and I started actually in childhood, was when I fear, I have to walk through the fear and take a dare, because fear is immobilizing. But daring is action, and action leads to hope. And so when I was a kid, you know, of 8 years old, and I'd be in the 10 and under swimming race, and all the boys would be twice as big as I was, I'd just stand with my toes curled over the edge of the dock and say, you know, you're little, but you're fast. You know, you can win this. And just plunge in and dare. And that whole image of just taking the dive into the cold water and swimming as fast as you can, you might have a chance to actually win. And so I've just followed that all my life. And when I fear, I dare.
Hmm. We're speaking with Gail Sheehy, and we're talking about her memoir called Daring My Passages. Your memoir, of course, after a very intriguing foreword, then begins with your childhood and your parents and their marriage, which, among other things, meant your own mother stifling her dreams to become an opera singer. In your words, men who wore who rode the commuter trains to New York and competed for the prettiest split level and the latest Chrysler model and played golf all day Saturday had wives who did not work. They were part of the furnishings of a successful man's house. I wonder at what point you became conscious of the fact that your life ultimately sprang out of that kind of marriage, and you ultimately forged what was a very different path for yourself, one in which you would not suppress your own professional longings. At what point did it become clear to you that you were stepping away from the life that your mother had chosen to lead?
I think I thought I realized that quite early. I was enormously loving to my mother, but she was she would leave the dinner table after serving a wonderful meal and have a sinus attack. And it turned out those sinus attacks were disappearing into alcohol. That was her way of, you know, disappearing from a life that was just only half a life. And and when she would drink, she would be marvelously fun, and everybody thought she was the life of the party. But inside, she was half alive. And so I never wanted that life. And I actually made a vow to myself that I wouldn't get married for at least 2 years after I finished college. And in those days, that was rather advanced, because most people had to have a ring on their finger when they graduated.
Yeah, you're the first woman in your family to go to college.
Right.
Ahead of that, I wonder if you would tell our listeners one of my favorite stories in the book, which is about a way in which you managed to achieve escape again and again and again from this home. And that escape, those little temporary escapes, would be off to Grand Central Station, of all places. Tell our listeners about that. It's a remarkable story.
Well, my grandmother was the stability, was my pole star. She lived with us, and she would keep my secrets. We used to listen to a program on Saturday mornings called Grand Central Station, Crossroads of a Million Private Lives, and all this wonderful, exciting music. So I wanted to go to Grand Central Station because we lived in a suburb, and it was boring. Who could you write about? And my grandmother had given me my first typewriter when I was 7 years old, and so I was writing these little stories. So when I was about 9 or 10, I said, Grandma, I have to go to Grand Central. So she kept my secret, gave me some money, and I rode my bike to the station. Somebody helped push me up on the old washboard trains, had high stairs, and I rode into Grand Central and walked up to the balcony all that looks over the main area, and started seeing all these fascinating lives, you know, a man with a Borsellino hat stopping a woman with a slouch hat, and the two of them with dark glasses and conferring and then moving away. And they must be communists exchanging papers. Wow. And, you know, seeing a man who was with one leg on the floor who was begging and imagining, and he had a trumpet with him, imagining that he would go out at night and put on his false leg and be a real jazz artist and have another life. And writing these stories and coming back and sharing them with my grandmother was one of the high points of my childhood.
At the end of chapter 2, where you speak about your childhood, you write these words. This is just as you're about to go off to college. I wanted the fragments of my young life to link up and convey the satisfying feeling one gets from piecing together a puzzle. I was my grandmother's child, plucky and selfish and determined to be a writer. I was my mother's child, a cute little shrimp who liked being on stage. I was my father's child, coached to be as competitive as boys and sent out in the world to win for him. But there are puzzle pieces that I left out, jagged pieces that didn't fit into a neat, coherent picture. I think that's so interesting because I have a feeling, on the one hand, most of us, if we look back at our childhood, might be able to say that. And yet, on the other hand, you do seem to have emerged from a childhood that was exceptionally complex. And it's probably part of why you are the woman you are today.
Well, I think you're right. If it had been a completely intact family with a faithful husband and a wife who had been able to find her own passion and give voice to it, I might have. Or if it had been, if either of my parents had been enormously successful, and I know what the problem that produces for a child, because my daughter was the daughter of a publicly successful mom, and that's been difficult for her to find her own identity and establish her own way. So I have to say that I learned a great deal from that child. I certainly learned not to be an alcoholic, and although I came close to falling into that trap way later in my life when my husband was slowly dying, and I felt that I was too. But I did find the 12-step program, and I found that enormously helpful to guide my life thereafter. Mm. But anyway, the childhood thing, the aha moment came when my sister, 9 years younger, read that first draft of the childhood chapter and said, Gail, you're giving the impression that our father was your great, you know, supporter for all your life as a writer. She said, remember all of the magazine articles you sent to him and all the books that you wrote you sent to him? He never read a single word because you were more successful than he.
Mm-hmm. That really speaks volumes, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Hmm. And then I had to go back and excavate. Well, what was that relationship like? And what was it like when he came to me in a hotel room in New York where I was on, I was a visiting reporter from Rochester, New York, and I was on a deadline, and my father insisted to come and talk to me. And what did he want to tell me about? He was leaving my mother and going to California with a woman younger than I and starting his life all over again. And meanwhile, abandoning my younger sister, who was only in her first year of college. So I then became my sister's surrogate mother. And as I looked at my life when I came to the end of it, I thought, gee, I've been a caregiver many times, somewhat for my mom, for my younger sister, put her through college and graduate school, and then ultimately for my husband. He gave me my career and my start in life, and I think I helped to give him an extra 10 or 15 years of productive and joyful life, even when he had cancer several times.
You tell a couple of very interesting stories during your college years, including a near elopement, which ends very interestingly, but we'll leave that to our listeners to explore. I want to ask you just a quick word about the first job you had after college. It was not any kind of journalism job. It was a job with JCPenney. And in fact, you tell us you were interviewed by Mr. JCPenney, Mr. James Cash Penny himself. And this was one of those, I'm so glad you talk about this, because this is one of those jobs that at a glance would seem so completely inconsequential, particularly now. And especially for Gail Sheehy, all of you have accomplished looking back over your life. And yet you look back at this job you had with JCPenney with great fondness. And it had some lasting importance to you. Tell our listeners about that.
Did. I went to JCPenney headquarters in New York, not just the store, and they had a management training program. And so I went to the middle managers and I asked if I could be in the management. You know, they only had men, of course. They didn't know what to do with me. So they ultimately kicked me upstairs to James Cash Penny's office, and I go in and, you know, this jolly old man with a big mustache, of white mustache and suspenders, and he's interviewing me in a very paternalistic way, and he said, well, yes, we should bring a girl into the management training program. And then these words came out of my mouth. I don't know where I got the courage. I said, well, do you pay the girls as much as the men? And he was startled and said, well, we should. And they did. And that was my first pre-feminist act, was to try to get equal pay. And that was a wonderful job. It turned out they sent me all over the country to put on fashion shows using Penny products. So I got to travel, you know, to Milwaukee, to Abilene, Kansas, to, all the little towns, Oshkosh, and get to know America, and also get to know how to be a stage presence, because I had to put on these fashion shows. So it turned out I worked there for 2 years, and it was one of the best learning experiences professionally that I've had.
Your career as a writer begins also as you are essentially a single mother. I wonder if you ever, how much you think that is really important. That is, the timing of your first really serious writing coinciding with also this turbulence in your personal life, of what difference it would have made if that story would have begun at a different point in your life. I mean, if life had been more stable, would that storyline have begun at all?
It would have begun. I would always have been a writer, but I might very well have been much less daring, because I would have had a successful husband who was practicing medicine, and so I could write and mother and do the things that, you know, young moms do together. But I had to work full time. There was no question about it. We had rent to pay, and I had a great goal. My goal was to send my daughter to private school so she would get into a really good college and maybe go to graduate school. I wanted her to go beyond where I was able to, and as you know, I was the first in my family to go to college at all. So I did accomplish that. But I had to leave the job at the Herald Tribune, which I loved, to be with my daughter and not, you know, palm her off on incompetent people who used to be, they used to park, their boyfriends would park their pimp mobiles beneath my fourth floor walk-up. That scared the bejesus out of me. So I did give that up, and I had to write from home. And if I had to write from home, I had to write after I put her to bed, and I would write sometimes the whole night to get enough product out there that it would pay the rent. And that taught me a lot of discipline and gave me a lot of different. I wrote for Cosmopolitan. Helen Gurley Brown used to call me up and say, "Hi, Pussycat. I want you to do another story." And I would say, "Great, you know, give me the assignment." She sent me off to India to interview the Maharishi. That was my first time out of the country. How thrilling was that? And I wrote for lots and lots of other magazines and four books before I wrote Passages.
In Chapter 5, you talk about your first significant encounter with Clay Felker, of course, a legendary figure in the publishing world and someone who eventually became your lover and then your husband. When you describe this first meeting with him in this chapter called Seduction at the Algonquin, you write, only much later did Clay divulge his secret. His way of seducing writers was to get inside their heads by interviewing them more like a shrink than an editor. He probed for your obsession, the subject you couldn't shake, the mind chatter that goes on in your head at 400 words a minute, your holy hang-up. Then he would know how to match you with one of hundreds of ideas floating around in his brain. That is so brilliant, but we also, as you describe that, realize that's certainly not the way probably most people operated then or now in the world of publishing.
No, I'm much more likely they want you to write and conform to their idea of how a story should be told and how many words. And now it's always going to be, I mean, you're lucky if it's 1,000 words. In those days, we wrote long-form, new journalism, which was often, you know, 4,000 or 5,000 words, and later at Vanity Fair I was writing pieces that were 8,000 and 10,000 words and took, you know, at least a month to research, sometimes 3 or even 6 months. So, but Clay's way of interviewing you like a shrink led to our understanding, our connection. His wife had left him for another man and devastated him. My husband had betrayed me with another woman. So we had a bond, and was one of the reasons it took us 17 years before we got married, because we were terrified of being in the position where we could be abandoned or betrayed again.
And he ends up asking you to write the story of a modern marriage dissolving, right, disintegrating. And that doesn't seem like a revolutionary idea now, but it was a revolutionary idea then.
Oh, it was. And, of course, I was writing it from the point of view of the wife who was, you know, trying to figure out how to live with an unfaithful husband or leave him. And it was right, it was 2 years before the women's movement broke out. So when it was published, I got a horrific review in the New York Times by a conservative person who wanted to put everything back in the bottle. You know, what is this thing where marriage is coming apart when you have two professionals and they have a child and everything should just be as it should? I realized that you have to really take into account where your audience might be when you're writing about things that are not yet acceptable.
You write, of course, in great detail about some of the remarkable assignments you were given, including one you've already briefly mentioned, that of covering some of the 1968 presidential campaign of Robert Kennedy, a campaign which, of course, ended with his assassination in California. You really share with us some remarkable observations you made as you followed him. In particular, I'm haunted by your account of what Bobby Kennedy was like in rural Oregon encountering Americans who had very little sympathy for him and some who had an outright hatred for so much of what he represented. And mm-hmm. it's really chilling. And we don't stop to think about a presidential candidate confronting that kind of animosity, and particularly when we know what is about to befall Mr. Kennedy.
Well, this was the thing I found just heroic about him. He had a brother who'd been assassinated and, you know, sent trauma and chills through every American. And this was only 5 years later. And he's going to these rural towns and standing up on the steps of City Hall, surrounded by men with guns and shotguns and rifles hanging over their shoulders, and half of them having some kind of an animal on their on the other shoulder, for scary-looking men, and talking to them about limiting the spread of guns. He knew he was a target. His family had been, you know, was full of death. And so the revelation for me came when we were flying in a very small plane through rain squalls in Oregon, up and down the Cascade Mountains. And at one point, as we were trying to land in Seattle, another plane was heading straight toward us, but we couldn't see it. Suddenly, our little craft drops like a stone. I'm screaming, men are screaming. Suddenly, in the middle of this fall, Bobby Kennedy quips, "I knew Gene McCarthy was desperate. I didn't know he was that desperate." And I thought, this is a man who is a total fatalist. He is not afraid of death. That's what allows him to go into these rural towns in Oregon. That's what allowed him to, in Indianapolis, go into a crowd of black people who did not know that Martin Luther King had just been assassinated, and to be the one to tell them. And although the police told him, don't do it, he did it. And he then made common cause with them, saying, I had a brother who was killed, too, by a white man. I know what you're feeling today. And that was one of the only cities that did not break out into riots at the death of Martin Luther King. Hmm.
Your chapter about the creation of New York Magazine also spends a bit of time talking about this notion of the new journalism and the kind of writing that you and other writers of the day had the opportunity to do. And you describe yourself at this point in time, at least, as seeing yourself as half hippie, half striver. Can you explain what those intriguing words mean?
Well, I was living on the Lower East Side in a fourth floor walk-up at a time when a lot of artsy types, musicians and Patti Smith and a lot of writers and all kinds of young creative people were living amidst a lot of very poor people and a lot of privileged suburban kids who were, you know, the earliest hippies and came to the Lower East Side to smoke pot and get in trouble and have a lot of fun and protest their privileged lives. But I also, as you know, had to work, had to make a success, had to support myself and a child. So I was a striver in that way, and so were a lot of people who came out of that era in the Lower East Side.
You also talk about your struggle to sort of come to terms with feminism, and particularly those who were really leading the charge of feminism in the late 60s and early 70s. You write this at one point. Here was the dilemma for me in those early times: how to preserve the best of our inborn feminine nature, our nurturing, compassionate, and ferociously protective instincts, our insights, our powers of love, and yes, female attraction, which are vital in ameliorating the more aggressive nature of men, while we discovered our power to say no to inequality. Up until that moment in 1969, I did not consider myself a feminist. I thought of myself as a humanist. What happened to ultimately, how did you ultimately resolve this dilemma within yourself in terms of whether or not to, how to label yourself, how to characterize what your attitudes were about this, and how to live your life in this evolving world in which you found yourself?
Well, I tell the story, which I can't at length here, about a particular evening when Clay Felker asked Gloria Steinem and Barbara Goldsmith and myself, three writers for his magazine, to have a dinner conversation for the benefit of his investors with a biological anthropologist, Lionel Tiger, who was, you know, antediluvian when it came to relations between men and women and feminism. And he just sat there and pronounced that, you know, women from 30 to 40 would have to forego having children if they wanted to have any kind of a career. And men were really the dominant species, and women just had to take a second role, an important role, but secondary, and so on. And the pill was the worst invention of the century. It would make men irrelevant. All kinds of fantastic statements were making our blood boil, but we did not fight back. We hardly fought back. Gloria did a little bit of it. I did almost none. Barbara did almost none. We went down to the street at the end of the party and said, we will never, ever keep our mouths shut again. This has to stop.
One of the most powerful experiences for you in this period is quite unexpected. You talk about it in a chapter called Fighting Irish Women, in which you experience something quite unexpected, which really leaves you with the lingering effects of what we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder. Explain to our listeners what happened to you and what the lasting ramifications of it was, the way in which this event, this brush with death really, the way in which it changed you in some powerful ways.
Well, I was only 32, and this was 1972, and I persuaded Clay Felker to send me to Northern Ireland at the peak of the Troubles. It was Derry. It was a Sunday. It was what came to be called Bloody Sunday. It all happened so fast, I still have a hard time believing it. We had participated in a civil rights march from the Catholic ghetto down to the center of Derry and met the British soldiers at the barricade. They tossed their tear gas into our midst. We vomited the tear gas. We dragged those dented by rubber bullets back to safety. And now we were all dropping back to a square, and neighbors were greeting neighbors. And I climbed up an outdoor staircase and a balcony over a block of flats to get a better view. And as I'm looking down at the armored cars lined up, I'm standing next to a young boy, and I ask him, how do the paratroopers fire their gas canisters so far? He says, see them jamming their rifle butts against the ground? And out of the blue, a bullet tears into his face. And it just, his eye becomes a bloody mess, and he falls at my feet. And I bend over him thinking, well, how can I mend him? Because up to that time in my life, I was able to put things back together. But he was bleeding to death, and there's crossfire. IRA sharpshooters are on the roof over us, and they're firing back. And the paratroopers are jackknifing out of their armored cars and plunging into the crowd with these automatic rifles, spraying the crowd with bullets. People crowded in on me. We formed a kind of caterpillar, inching on our bellies up the outdoor staircase in the crossfire. And somebody had to crawl out and bang on a door to get us taken into safety. Well, I wasn't about to volunteer, but then a bullet passed just inches in front of my own nose and seemed to hang in midair. And that was the moment when that whole carapace of illusions from childhood dissolved. And I crawled out on the crossfire and hurled myself against the door, and we were taken into safety. And when we later had to lie on our stomachs to avoid bullets coming in through the window, a powerful new thought took hold, which is, I'm alone. There's no one who's always going to be with me. There's no one who's always going to keep me safe. And that is the first realization of one's mortality. If I had been a man, I might have had that realization when I was 18 years old in the Army, but I was a woman, and this was the first time at 32. And it was really a premature midlife crisis that came on after that. But it led me to question, when I looked over many, many interviews that I had done with people in their late 30s and early 40s, and they very often said things like, you know, I feel like time is running out, or why is my life, does it feel unsatisfying to me? I thought I was on the right track. A lot of disequilibrium and uncertainty. And I began to understand that there was a time in life when that happens. And eventually that term became midlife crisis. But I wanted to write about that, that there were predictable crises as well as life accidents like Ireland. So I changed my contract and asked for a contract to do that, and that took me 3 years and became Passages.
Which is, of course, one of the most influential books ever read, written, and, of course, influential books read by millions. And one of the things you end up exploring in that book is what occurred to you to be perhaps a natural dissynchrony between men and women's development. That is, they were not necessarily in perfect sync, the passages of a man's life versus a woman's life, and the fact that there isn't perfect synchronicity might help explain why sometimes relationships between men and women can really be quite volatile if one is undergoing certain storms and turbulence that the other has not yet experienced.
Well, you know, at the time I was doing the research in the early 70s, there were only about a handful of men doing research on adult development, and they were only studying other men because it was just taken for granted that the only proper adult life cycle is the male life cycle, which is impossible for women to follow, largely because of our reproductive system. So when women get to mid-30s, and it's still true, even with the reproductive revolution that allows people to have babies much longer, but it's almost as if a gong rings at 35. And if a woman hasn't had a child yet, or even if she's had only one or two and wants more, there is this gong that rings saying, time is running out. When are you going to make a decision or make something happen? And I wrote one of the first stories about bachelor mothers when I was one myself, which at that time was really an anomaly and not respected. And now it's the norm for many lower middle class women, and even for educated women, having a baby and with somebody who might be living with you or a casual partner, thinking about it as a lifelong commitment that would benefit from having two parents, and then maybe another fellow moves in at another point, and then maybe getting married, you know, several years later. And I understand why a lot of women do that, because they're not at all sure that men today, or young men, are going to be able to, you know, launch and be providers, and that they might get stuck being the breadwinner, as many women are today. So, but it's a very dangerous situation, and I get off on that soapbox because I think it's not a healthy way to build an equitable economic situation. It's one of the main reasons for the disparity in income levels, because of so many single moms who have to struggle to do just what I did, try to put together a working life and a mothering life.
Hmm. Two more quick questions. You've been so generous with your time. We have yet to talk about one of the most important stories which you covered, which ultimately became something of a mission for you and ultimately led to you adopting a beautiful young girl from Cambodia. I wonder if you could just say a word about this unexpected pathway on which you found yourself.
Well, I was on a trip, a most romantic trip, with Clay in around Asia, and we ended up in Bangkok, and we were sitting there on the Oriental Hotel having a wonderful breakfast, and Clay, who was always, you know, ahead of the time, knew that I was heartsick that my daughter was going off to college and I was going to have an empty nest, and I hadn't had the joy of an intact family for many years. He said, reading the Bangkok Post, maybe there's a child for you here. I said, what are you talking about? He said, well, there's all these unaccompanied minors, children of Pol Pot who genocide left behind, and they're in refugee camps in right here in Thailand, and the Reagan administration has shut down the pipeline, so they have nowhere to go. And I said, adopt a child? I never thought of it, certainly not a foreign child. Well, within an hour, I said, we have to go to those camps. He said, it's our last day. And I said, but, you know, this is a chance of a lifetime. And we did go to the camps. We weren't able to see the children because there had been kidnappings. But coming back to JFK, I made a phone call from the airport to the New York Times Magazine and said, I'd like to write a story about the children America forgot. And he said, well, that's a very expensive trip to Cambodia. I said, well, I'll pay half. And a week later, I was back there and interviewed a number of children, the last one of whom was a substitute for a girl who couldn't come. And she had obviously been following me all around the camp. I had seen these eyes popping behind fences and kind of following my path. And she was all beautifully groomed with long black hair and a beautiful sarong. And she came in and we locked eyes, and we never took our eyes off each other. I had a translator, but we were really communing with one another. And the first question I asked her was, have you ever known a happy time? And her face just lit up, and the stoniness dissolved because nobody had time to ask her a question so frivolous. And she was able to talk about her family and how they lived in a lovely house in Phnom Penh with bougainvillea, and her father went to work on a motorcycle because he was a military policeman, I later learned. But when it came to talking about how her parents were taken away and what she thought happened to them, her face kind of almost dissolved. She put her head down. Her back was shaking with sobs, but you couldn't hear anything, and she wouldn't let you see her sorrow. And when she finally put up her head, her face was again composed. And I could see that she hadn't accepted the identity of refugee, that she might be able to survive such a culture shock of coming to another country and starting life over again. And I knew right then I was going to try to bring her out. And I had horrible difficulties. Ultimately, the Reagan administration tried to prevent me from bringing her out because I was writing op-ed pieces about our policy towards Southeast Asian refugees. But finally, 9 months later, coming in from a run in the park, pushing the button on my answering machine, I hear, Patmom arriving tomorrow night, JFK, 8 p.m. What? Child is dropping into my life. I'm not prepared. What do I do? And when I drove to the airport the next night, I stopped at a Chinese restaurant to get some rice for her on the way. Well, Cambodians hate Chinese rice. That's how ignorant I was of what to do. But boy, did we bond right from the beginning and walked out of that airport arm in arm, our legs in sync. And within a few months, she was had enough English that she could dictate stories to me for her English class. She was 12 years old and ultimately went to Wellesley and became an art therapist and did a lot of work with children of war, and today is a chef in an upstate New York inn.
It's an amazing story, as is the story of your ultimate marriage to Clay Felker, such an important figure in your life, and the way that the two of you journey through very different paths as his own professional fortunes and in some respects decline with the drastically changing landscape of magazine publishing, and his new professional life shadowed by some devastating health reversals. And you find yourself by the end of your marriage his caregiver, and you write so tenderly about this experience. What was it like in particular to, in a sense, revisit and I suppose in some ways even to relive some of these experiences in your last years with Clay?
Oh, it made me very, very melancholy. But then I also found the joy in it, all the unexpected joys that we had. And the main one was when he was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and the doctor, who was a humanist and knew who Clay was and man of intelligence, and he said, I'm not even going to give you any treatment because it won't extend your lifespan. which is about 10 years, what I want you to do is to go out and dare to do something you wouldn't have before this challenge and do it together. Wow. Well, we walked out of that office on a cloud, but then we had to come down to earth and actually figure out what could that be. And we spent almost every Sunday for the next year, walking in a nature preserve or a Central Park and chewing on the question, what was it about Clay's career that gave him such joy and a sense of purpose? And finally, one day, he had an aha moment and said, I know what it was. It was identifying and shaping young talent. And I said, well, then you could do that teaching. He said, oh, I don't want to be a stuffy academic. And I said, yes, but the University of California, Berkeley, has suggested to you you might come out and actually start a magazine-making program, teaching young journalists how to make magazines, what you do. And we came out to California, where I am now, in the Bay Area. He was so turned on. And all we had to do was tear up the life we'd spent 30 years building and publishing in New York and move across the country. But starting again, me in my early 50s, Clay in his 60s, was the best thing that could have happened. We fell in love again. We were young again. He had an enormously satisfying time of raising the next generation of young journalists. We had them over to our house all the time. And I wrote, in those next 10 years, I wrote 5 books. I had no idea that I did that much until I wrote the memoir. But it tells you how productive those years of our lives were under the shadow of cancer, which did ultimately return and take him down.
Mm. I love one thing you say at this point. You're just in the throes of that experience, and I believe about to write a book about how one looks back at the end of one, from the end of one's life. And you were going through all kinds of transcripts of so many interviews you'd done over the decades. And you wrote that, as I looked back on all that, I was on top of the mountain. If I stopped long enough to look around, the view was breathtaking. A 360-degree panorama of the roads taken, hills climbed, foolish detours, and crash sites. But I had survived. More than that, I had thrived. In many respects, that's really the heart and soul of what this memoir is about, isn't it?
Well, yes, that's kind of the summation. And I would never have gotten to write that paragraph if I hadn't written a memoir. I would not have really known how to evaluate my life. We don't stop long enough to do it. We're in such a rush to get to the next thing or, you know, finish the to-do list. I found it a relief. I forgave myself for some of the guilt that I carried, and I laughed at myself for some of the foolish moves I made, and I was happy with myself for having done some things and written some things that I think give ideas and hope and maybe a sense of, I could do this if I dared.
Well, there's so much in this book to explore, including your remarks about figures like Hillary Clinton and Margaret Thatcher and Gorbachev and so many other great writers, Gloria Steinem, and of course your observations about Clay and your life together, and especially those tender final years when you cared for him as the end of life drew near. All drawn together so impressively in this book called Daring My Passages, published by William Morrow. Gail Sheehy, I thank you so much for taking the time to write such a remarkable memoir about your remarkable life and for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. This has been a pleasure and honor for me.
Thank you so much for taking the time to take me through it again. Lovely to talk to you, Greg.
WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities online at carthage.edu. And support for WGTD's Morning Show comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea is a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. Right now, 2 above zero in Racine, 1 above in Kenosha, 1 below for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind chill, currently 16 below zero. This is WGTDHD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. NPR News and classical music on your gateway to public.